Welcome to episode 37 of the Cancer Pod. Join us as we discuss hair loss from cancer treatments, including what to expect, how to reduce the risk, and how to support hair regrowth with proper nutrients.
I'm Dr. Tina Kayser, and as Leah likes to say, I'm the sciencey one.
And I'm Dr. Leah Sherman, and I'm the cancer insider.
And we're two naturopathic doctors who practice integrative cancer care.
But we're not your doctors.
This is for education, entertainment, and informational purposes only.
Do not apply any of this information without first speaking to your doctor.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast by the hosts and their guests are solely their own.
Welcome to the Cancer Pod. Hey, Tina.
Hi, Leah.
Today, we are talking about something. It's a side that has a really big impact on a lot of patients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say it's one of the side effects that...
Ooh, you said it.
I said it. It's one that impacts the patient and is more incidental to the medical oncologist. So there's not a lot that is offered in way of preventing the side effect.
So what we're talking about today is hair loss, alopecia related to cancer treatments. And it's not funny, but it is kind of funny that like I went into treatment totally prepared for this, absolutely prepared. I knew it was going to happen. You know, my husband's like shaving my head into like mohawks, threatened to give me a Mr. T and everything. And I even have a video somewhere of me getting my hair shaved, and I'm just joking, and you know, everything's like humorous. And at one point, as my hair continued to fall out, I had a complete and utter meltdown in the shower, like knowing that this was going to happen, working with patients where this happens all the time. Mm-hmm. What it for me, and I think for many people, because I've talked to my patients about this too, is that's when it sets in. Mm. That's when it sets in that this is real.
You mean the entire experience?
The entire experience becomes real at that point because it's not a typical hair loss. Mm-hmm. Like it's just melting off of you. There's no control. So it's the ultimate loss of control. And it's how people on the outside now can see what is going on with you.
Yeah, that's an interesting point in that if it is something like you worked through it, you held your chin up and you kind of forged on. And I can see how that would be kind of shaking the very reality you not only put forth to other people, but to yourself as well.
And hair is such an identity thing. I remember my sister, I don't know if it was during my treatment or maybe it was another time when I just like happened to cut my hair off. But my sister at one point was like, you know, like that's your identity. Your identity is your hair. Like talking about me specifically, because I always had very long straight hair. Uh-huh. And so it was a really big deal. I mean, my hair was really, really long and then it wasn't.
Well, yeah. And I think that is true depending on how you wear your hair, because I can think of someone back in college who came home from France and she had beautiful black curls before she left and she came back and it was shaved so close she could have been in the ROTC at that point. I mean, it was super shaved. I didn't recognize her. She walked up the driveway. I literally looked at this person and didn't know who she was. And so it was profoundly different. I mean, she was the same person, of course, but you're right. Hair is a big part of our exterior identity to people and how they perceive us. So yeah, it's a major side effect. And I think it's one that probably doesn't get as much attention because it can be written off as superficial or not important or whatever by the conventional care team.
And by, you know, friends and family. Oh, it's just hair. It'll come back, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's not. It's a lot more than that. So this is what we are going to cover on this episode. Let's just do a short little musical break and come right back.
All right, we're back. So I think we should just talk about what hair does on our bodies. Just in general, why do we even have hair?
So some of our hair is protective. I would say like a lot of our hair is protective. Mm-hmm. And you don't really realize it until you lose it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, your eyebrows, your eyelashes, your nose hairs, they're all protecting you from what's on the outside. The tiny little hairs on your body. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of an important thing that you don't realize until you don't have it.
Yeah. I can totally understand how we all, any one of us who hasn't lost our hair, and especially our eyebrows and things that have a clear functional purpose on a day-to-day, take it for granted. And then when they're gone, you're like, oh, right, this keeps my sweat out. It keeps dust out. Your eyelashes have a serious purpose of keeping debris and pollen and dust out of your eyes. I mean, it's just, it's so simple, but it's so taken for granted unless it's not there.
Right. Yeah, the sweat thing was a really big thing. And not everybody, not every treatment, you know, you lose your eyebrows or your eyelashes. But when and if that happens, it's, yeah, you're kind of like, oh, now I get why I had those in the first place.
Yeah. Should we go through some of the drugs that are most common? I have a little list.
Okay.
It's alphabetical.
Nice.
I'll just run down the list.
Okay. Are you going to say like their trade names or their generic names?
I was just going to go generic.
Okay.
If you want to throw in a trade name in there,
I might,
feel free.
I might, right. Yeah, just because, you know.
All right, ready? I just pulled this off of up to date, I think. Cyclophosphamide when it's given IV.
So that's Cytoxan for breast cancer, typically, and other cancers.
Dactinomycin, daunorubicin, docetaxel, doxorubicin, epirubicin.
The Rubicin family.
Yes, known as the Rubicin family. We got the cousins, the brothers, the Rubicins.
Oh, I do want to mention docetaxel, actually, which is Taxotere. That is one where, for some people, hair loss can be permanent because there are lawsuits, and you hear about those a lot. If you start Googling docetaxel for any other reason, you'll start getting ads for the lawsuits. And so,
all right. Erbulin.
Erbulin. That's the one that's derived from a sea sponge.
Mm-hmm. Etoposide. Idarubicin.
Okay, we're back to the Rubicin family.
Yep. It's a large family. Irinotecan, ifosfamide, paclitaxel, topotecan, and vinorelbine. And these are the ones associated with the highest risk of hair loss, the kind you're talking about where it comes out quickly and in a lot. And there are other drugs associated with hair thinning and have a little bit lower risk, but those are all the big dogs.
So yeah, hair thinning can be a side effect as well. I think I've told this story before. Well, I may be repeating myself, but yeah. So one of the treatments that isn't listed, or some of the regimens that aren't listed, would be like 5-FU and oxaliplatin. I have had patients that come in for their appointments before even getting their chemo teach and just like shave their heads in preparation. And that was their planned treatment.
Uh-huh.
Don't do that, because you're most likely not going to lose your hair. It may thin a little bit, but don't pre-shave your head unless you know for sure you're going to lose your hair, or unless you just want to shave your head. Maybe you just want to shave your head.
Sure. There are quite a few agents associated with hair thinning. Those two that you just mentioned, as well as carboplatin, cisplatin. There's several others. So there's a lot of them that are associated with hair thinning. The first list had to do with complete hair loss and more severe effects.
Like for breast cancer patients, you've got the three big hitters, right? You've got doxorubicin, cyclophosphamide, and any taxane. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's pretty much guaranteed.
Yep. And I should add that there's a few oral agents too. You know, like cetuximab is one of the very first targeted agents for a specific receptor, EGFR. In any case, that can often have side effects, including hair thinning.
And we're not only talking about like hair thinning and hair loss, we're also... we'll mention things about hair texture and color changes. And there are some treatments that can change the color of your hair.
Mm-hmm.
And after hair loss, hair can come back and it can be a completely different texture. So we'll touch on that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that happened to my father when he got chemotherapy.
His hair color changed.
Yeah. His hair color changed when it was fairly gray, salt and pepper with a good amount of salt. And after getting high-dose methotrexate, it turned more peppery. So he was happy about that.
And it can also happen with cisplatin and cyclophosphamide. It's not a guarantee. The hair color changes, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's just something to kind of keep in mind. Hair loss can also happen with radiation to the scalp.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that's a completely different mechanism. I mean, that's just, you're just getting direct blast to the hair follicles.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess, why do we even lose our hair with these treatments? And it all goes back to what we talk about pretty much every side effects issue, rapidly dividing cells.
Yep.
And hair is, I mean, that has some of the most rapidly dividing cells in our body.
Mm-hmm.
And so that mm-hmm. definitely is a target.
Yeah, it's part of that whole idea of collateral damage, because except for those oral targeted agents, all of these chemotherapies that go in intravenously are non-selective. They're just killing rapidly dividing cells, regardless of where they are. And in the process of killing the cancer cells, they take out other rapidly dividing cells like the hair follicles.
And what I thought was cool in review for this, and I'm not going to go into it a lot, but just the fact that hair grows in cycles.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like a growing phase, a changing phase, and a resting phase. And so when our hair naturally falls out, it's because there's another hair and coming in behind it. It kind of pushes it out.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing I thought was kind of neat is like, if you think about hair follicle, but then there's also like this bulb that's down as part of our whole hair makeup. And that bulb has tiny little capillaries.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how those drugs get to your hair, is through the little blood, there's a blood source down there. So that's why when our hair falls out naturally, that it doesn't bleed. But, if somebody was to yank, your hair really hard, then could bleed.
Yeah, right.
Oh, I wanted to cover the different types of hair too. There is the terminal hair, which is what we see, what we think of, our eyebrows, our eyelashes, our pubic hair, our hair on our heads, our facial hair. And then there's this, I think it's pronounced vellus or vellus hair,
mm-hmm.
which is that tiny fuzz that it's more noticeable, I think, on women. It's just, and babies have it too. It's just kind of like that peach fuzz that's mm-hmm. that's on our, kind of the rest of our bodies. And then there is this, I don't know how it's pronounced, lanugo hair. And that's what babies are born with. Like they're with babies that are kind of born with like this coating of hair. And it's also something that can be seen in people with eating disorders. And that's kind of like a diagnostic for if somebody does have an eating disorder. And I believe that also is very protective. And so that helps with temperature regulation, because I would think if someone has a lot of weight loss, then the mm-hmm. body needs to compensate. So those are the different types of hair. And with certain chemotherapies, you're going to lose the terminal and the vellus. Yeah. And then they grow back in interesting ways. But we'll get to that. Because I got a story for almost every side effect.
That's right. Yeah. When we talk about all of these side effects, basically, if it was listed, you got it.
Except for the nausea, yeah. And the diarrhea. Oh,
except for the nausea. Which you were on top of, though. Well, let's be clear. You took a medication. So
I took a medication, and that's why I also didn't have the diarrhea. But there you mm-hmm. go. Okay. So we move on. Let's move on. Patients always want to know what they can do to prevent hair loss.
Yes. So can I just say, as far as natural agents go, unless it's been proven, stay away from a natural agent that's claimed to fame as, I'm taking this to prevent hair loss, because you could be doing it because you're decreasing the effectiveness of the actual treatment, right? So I say that because this is where those areas where I'm really cautious, and I look more towards nutrient deficiencies that might be induced and making sure someone's not deficient in certain things, which we're going to talk about. But I'm saying that because when something out there has proof saying, oh, you don't get that side effect if you just take this, I don't care if it's a drug or a natural agent, you have to ask yourself, am I doing that at the cost of effectiveness of the actual chemotherapy? Because if you speed up its breakdown in your body, you might be getting rid of it more quickly than is planned by your medical oncologist.
And really the only thing that's been looked at are the cold caps, cryotherapy. A lot of cancer centers now have them for their patients, or patients can buy them themselves and bring them in.
Mm-hmm.
And even those aren't 100%. I know some patients start off really like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to use this cap and I'm going to preserve my hair. And then weeks later, I'll see them and they don't have their cap on because it was just too much. Either whether it's the cold induced headaches or, mm-hmm. Their hair still was thinning. And so they're just like, oh, I'm just going to cut it all off. I mean, so there are mixed results. Some people have great results using a cold cap.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand the desire for that. When I was a resident back in 2000, 2002, they were frowned upon because that was the early generation and all medical oncologists saw the data, the preliminary data back in the 90s, or maybe it was even the 80s, that said that they were associated with increasing the risk of cancer to the skull itself, which the skull is a bone. So if you have a cancer that travels to the bone or has a propensity to go to bone, there was some concern around that. Now, fast forward 15 years later, the FDA did approve a cold cap specifically. I don't know what year it was, but about 15 years later. And there appears to be safety studies already done on that. There's still echoes of those concerns, though. So I know that there are differing opinions out there, even within the medical oncology community, should you or shouldn't you wear it? My feedback from patients who have done it, who have tried it, is I had a lot of people quit as well because of the discomfort, you know? I think the headache induction and then just incredibly cold on their head, and they're like, they took the hair loss over the discomfort.
And when looking at up to date to see what they discussed with cold caps, it's for patients with solid tumors only. It's not for patients with hematologic malignancies like leukemia and lymphoma, small cell and squamous cell lung cancer, certain skin cancers. They were very, very specific as to which cancers it's contraindicated.
Yeah, which makes sense. Wherever you put cold to the vascular system, whether it's your head or your hands or your feet, if you're putting cold to that area, you're going to reduce blood flow, which reduces the delivery of the chemotherapeutic. And if that's undesirable, then it's going to be contraindicated.
Yeah. So any patients that I have that are like, oh, well, I was going to take biotin during treatment. I mean, there's such debate around using biotin in the first place, but I'm like, that's like throwing a pebble at a giant. Like you were saying, make sure that you're taking in all of the nutrients to grow healthy hair.
Exactly. Yeah. So biotin is one of them, because if you're deficient in biotin, you will have poorer hair growth, regrowth.
And biotin comes from eggs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that's one that's top of mind. So if you're eating eggs, then egg yolks is a great source. And where else is it found?
Legumes, nuts and seeds, and some other stuff. Liver. Oh, I said it. I wasn't going to say liver because I always have to say liver like I'm in New York.
It's the only way. Oh, liver is also high in zinc. That's another nutrient deficiency.
Oh, so are nuts and seeds. Nuts and seeds, high in zinc.
Yeah, look at that. Zinc is one of those things that a lot of people are deficient in during treatment. And I can say that because we used to test it routinely. And then we just stopped testing and just assumed everyone needed a little bit because we tested enough people. After hundreds of people, and the vast majority were deficient in zinc when they're being treated for cancer at the hospital where I was at, it was basically a lot less expensive and a lot easier to just give a small dose of zinc or have people eat high zinc foods than it was to test them, which costs them money. So we just, you know, after saying the chances of this are really good. So make sure that you're getting zinc in your diet or you're taking a supplement, and then protein in general. If you're low in protein, if you're not eating well, amino acids are needed. And then some other B vitamins besides biotin, which is in the B vitamin family.
It's vitamin B7.
Biotin is B7. Mm-hmm. Yes. And folate is B9. Remember?
But it's not benign.
Right. We had a folate episode. Anyways, especially B12. So if you're low in vitamin B12, which is uncommon in those with cancer, but does happen if you're not eating well or if you're vegan. And then selenium. Selenium is one of those with hair loss where too little selenium and selenium toxicity, too much selenium, both cause loss of hair.
So protein from animal sources has B12 in it, because I am not one to encourage people to take B12 usually during treatment unless they have a frank deficiency. And some people may not be digesting properly because of whatever treatments they're on, you know, whatever procedures they've had, you know, from stress can kind of cause issues in terms of breaking down foods. So maybe just even taking some sort of a digestive enzyme to make sure that, you know, that when you're eating animal protein, that you're actually breaking it down.
Yeah. And for those who do have a cancer that affects their stomach or their upper intestines, that's one scenario where B12 under the tongue or some kind of sublingual would be needed. But that's the only one I can think of where it would be necessary. Or if you're vegan. I mean, this is the other folks who might need a B12 supplement.
And it doesn't need to be that super high dose. It doesn't need to be 1,000 micrograms. I mean, it can be a very, very low dose.
It doesn't have to be daily. B12 is stored up in the liver a little bit. Mm-hmm. So generally speaking, we can have enough stored up for a good 6 months or so. So you don't have to be, it's not one of those, it's not like vitamin C, like you have to take it in every day because we can't store it. It's not like that. I do want to mention that in people who are losing their hair, this is a slight tangent, but I want to mention it because we're talking about supplements. If it's due to an androgen dominant state, meaning they have a lot of testosterone, or women on aromatase inhibitors who, relative to the estrogen, there's more testosterone, because yes, you still make testosterone. Fish oil has been used. So making sure that you're not deficient in omega-3 fatty acids.
Ooh, jinx. I do want to talk about something that I think a lot of people don't really think about until it happens to them. It's the pain that can happen, scalp pain from hair loss. That is a very real thing. And it can be described different ways. You know, oftentimes people feel it when they're just, the pressure of their head on a pillow. I describe it as if somebody yanked your ponytail really hard, but nobody's pulled your hair. And sometimes you don't even have any hair, but you have that pain. What I used for myself after my head was shaved, I would massage coconut oil into my scalp regularly. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'd put one little drop of peppermint oil to distract.
Oh,
I even used that Dr. Bronner's peppermint soap on my scalp and a little, what are those? It's like plastic, like shower poofs, the little plastic loofah type things.
Yeah.
And I gently massaged my scalp with that too.
And that helped.
I think the peppermint worked to distract. And then the massaging was just to kind of keep those, like the follicles and the, whatever they're called, the sebaceous glands, the oil glands in my hair, my head, keep them open. Because I think people don't always realize you continue to, keep washing your scalp, even though you don't have hair.
Right.
And then I liked that gentle exfoliation just to kind of keep circulation and I don't know. That was just a little thing that I did.
Well, that's interesting because I like that idea. That's a really nice idea.
And when the hair comes back, sometimes people get folliculitis, which is an infection of the hair follicle. And so I just figured by, just gently, I'm not scrubbing until it's red, but just gently keeping that dead skin off. Mm-hmm. It's going to make sure that the oils are still coming through.
And I would imagine the coconut on top of that also is good for the biome, the skin bacteria, and preventing folliculitis as well.
Oh, because it has like antimicrobials naturally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it smells good. And it just, I mean, I was babying skin that hadn't been seen since I was a baby. So,
yeah. Well, on that note, some folks also go out and buy baby shampoo, which has very little in it. Burt's Bees makes a nice one that has no fragrance and nothing else in it. And I'm thinking about you adding the peppermint oil and how essential oils in general are antibacterial. You do have to dilute it because they can also be very drying and somewhat irritating directly on the skin. So you diluted it in your coconut oil and used it that way around the loofah. Or not, it's not a loofah. It's a scrunchie. It's a poof.
It's a poof.
You diluted it on your bath poof.
On my poof.
In any case, that also worked as an antimicrobial.
Yeah. But that, so that pain is something that is, and it, some people it's painful and some people it's just discomfort. Like I said, you feel it mostly when you're still laying in bed. I would think, I did not try this, but I would think using like a silk pillowcase would even help because that has less friction on your scalp because you really want to reduce friction. So maybe like a silk or satin pillowcase would probably be helpful.
I like that idea too.
And I'm trying to think what else. What do we go to next? We've got, when it comes to the hair loss in general, usually it's not immediate. It usually starts, I'm going to say about like 3 weeks in, 2 to 3 weeks in, depending on your treatment. And it's not just on your head. It can be anywhere that there's hair. I've had female patients say, like, why is my leg hair still here? Like, why have I not lost my leg hair? It's not picky. I mean,
yeah,
it can happen eventually. And then what I found ironic was my leg hair was the first to grow back. And I'm like, really? Really? My leg hair. Thanks a lot. And I don't know, other things that are kind of interesting, you know, with the loss of eyelashes is there are people who put on fake eyelashes. And I did not do that because I held on to my last eyelash till its last possible moment. Like I have pictures of like a close-up of my eye of like, this is my last lash. But yeah, I mean, you can use fake eyelashes. They have those like the magnetic eyeliners that the lash can stick to. But I mean, there are all kinds of little makeup tricks.
Okay, wait, stop. There's magnetic eyeliner that eyelashes can stick to?
Yeah.
That's news to me.
I've never used those and I've heard mixed results from people, but yes,
interesting.
It's kind of a weird thing. I do have one tip for people who are concerned about eyebrows, or, you know, like people like me who really aren't into doing a lot of makeup and don't have practice with drawing eyebrows on. I went to Sephora beforehand at somebody's recommendation and I learned how to draw on my eyebrows and they sold me like the brush and the little kit.
Uh-huh.
And someone taught me like, this is the shape of your eyebrows and this is how you should draw them. I was great at it. I mean, you got a little art school thrown in.
I was just going to say, you are an artiste.
No, but it was like, I got a good lesson too. So that's kind of that's a hot tip.
All right.
I guess I could have included that in the hot tip section, but I didn't.
No, I like that. That's a great idea. It's kind of along the same lines as I know I would always advise patients who are taking a treatment that is likely to lead to complete hair loss to go see if they choose or they plan to get a wig, I would tell them to go do that beforehand so they could see their hair. So the person who does the wigs can see the natural hair and go from there.
Oh, that's a good segue to the coverings. Yeah. So the wig thing, I mean, it's a cranial prosthesis, right? I mean, you get a prescription. The last cancer center where I worked at had a salon where patients could go, the stylist could see what their hair looked like. And then often they would have their hair cut a little shorter, which is another good tip is if you do have long hair, transition, just don't go from long to bald, but you can transition to a shorter haircut and get fit for a wig. You can order them off of Amazon, but why not go to a salon that specializes in this and have it cut to your face and show you how to actually fit a wig.
Yeah.
I do encourage people if they want to go to Amazon, order a bunch of them, but then to even take that and like adjust it, because that was something I really didn't know a lot about was you cut wigs to your face. You can cut a wig and you want someone who knows what they're doing because it's not going to grow back. So.
Yeah. And I know out in the community, because you worked at a cancer center that was integrative. So they were taking care of patients on an individual basis and they had a great system there. Down in Eugene, when I was seeing patients in my clinic, there was a hairdresser, hair salon who would see the patients from the cancer center specifically. And I'm guessing they took insurance and that's why the patients were sent to that particular one. And they were well-versed in hair loss and how to help people out. And then of course they had the other stuff there too, but seeing them before you lose your hair is ideal. I know that much. I've been told that a few times by people in the business. So that makes a lot of sense.
There also are some resources for tying scarves. I used a YouTube video series, a woman who goes by Rapunzel, W-R-A-P-unzel, Rapunzel. And she is an Orthodox Jewish woman it's the tradition to cover your head. And so she would demonstrate all of these really interesting ways of doing scarves. There also is someone, I'm sure there are several people on Instagram, but there's one account in particular, Natasha After Cancer, and she does head wrap tutorials on Instagram. And so that's another great resource because scarves can be beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I found really nice, because the scarves were beautiful, but they were hard during, if you have hot flashes and then trying to take it off. It was the same with the wig. I wore the wig once. I got a Raquel Welch blonde wig. It was really nice. And it was too hot with my hot mm-hmm. flashes. And so I used a buff.
Mm-hmm.
They're like those tubes that people, gaiters.
Yep.
That people wear, and they come in a whole bunch of different patterns and colors. And that was easy. I learned that from a patient, actually. And you just kind of put the tube on your head and you can tuck it underneath. And it's nice to have to sleep in. It's nice to just take it off if you have a hot flash, and then you can put it back on without a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some tips. Oh, another little tip in shaving one's head is to use an electric razor. And don't go straight to the skin. You want to avoid any sort of nicks or cuts.
Mm-hmm.
So don't pull out the straight razor and the shaving cream. And, you know, that's really not recommended. It's typically just go with the lowest guard on mm-hmm. an electric razor.
So you're saying leave just an itty bitty bit of stubble so you're not going all the way down to the skin.
Mm-hmm.
That makes a lot of sense because you're immune suppressed during that time too.
Exactly. So I think we kind of covered hair loss. And so we can take a break and then come back and talk about what happens when the hair comes back.
Here's some factoids on hair. Our hair grows fastest between the ages of 15 and 30. Blondes have 10% more hair follicles than brunettes. And your hair grows faster in summer compared to winter.
Alrighty, so we are back. We covered hair loss with treatment. And now we're going to talk about what the heck happens as hair starts to come back. And I'm not going to say after treatment, because there are patients where hair starts to grow back during treatment.
Right.
And mm-hmm. they get concerned. And I don't think that there's any evidence out there showing that if your hair starts to come back during treatment, that it means anything.
Not that I know of. I've never seen anything that gives it any kind of meaning.
Yeah. And so that's not unusual. What is rare, as I mentioned at the beginning, is sometimes hair does not grow back.
Yes.
I've only seen one patient where that's happened. So in however many years I've been practicing, I've only had one patient. And she was not treated at the cancer center where I was working. It was a previous treatment.
Yeah, I think it's more common in those who undergo a stem cell transplant. So that might be some of the lymphomas, leukemias, multiple myeloma, when they undergo a stem cell transplant. Some of the drugs they use and the extremity of the dosage as well goes into that, and it becomes permanent.
Right. And as I mentioned previously, docetaxel is the one that's the most common for this rare occurrence of hair not coming back.
Yeah. Well, the docetaxel, I know that it's dose and duration dependent. And so if it's given in higher doses for longer periods of time, they're more likely to lead to permanent damage of the hair follicle and permanent alopecia, which is our fancy term.
Which is the fancy, that's the fancy term for hair loss. Yeah, we're already like towards the middle end and we just start dropping the fancy terms.
Well, we mentioned alopecia in the beginning, I think.
Did one of us say that?
Okay. We did.
I wasn't sure. And so, as we mentioned at the beginning, it's not only hair, you know, your hair comes back, but sometimes it looks different.
Mm-hmm.
So chemo curls are kind of like how they're known amongst cancer people. And sometimes it's just that initial hair that comes back that's curly. I remember flying from Arizona to New York to have my favorite hairdresser, who'd been cutting my hair since like I was in my early 20s. He was the one who cut my hair officially for my very first haircut after it grew back.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, yeah, I think I got those chemo curls out. And I was so excited. You know, he gave me this cute little kind of pixie cut. It was adorable. But I was just so happy because I just wanted my straight hair back. And then it kept growing and it was still curly and it's still curly to this day. So why does it happen? I don't really know, because I looked throughout the interwebs and it could be because of damage from the chemotherapy to the hair follicle. It could be hormonal changes that happened, because I am now postmenopausal mm-hmm. and that happened during treatment because of drugs I was given to, you know, to stop those hormones from being produced. Mm-hmm. So it could be about a bunch of different reasons. But yeah, it happens because that little hair shaft is a different shape depending on the texture of one's hair. And that can apparently change.
Yeah. And I read somewhere that up to 65% of people who get chemotherapy have hair changes afterwards when they do have a hair thinning or hair loss.
Permanent hair changes, like
mm-hmm. Yeah, what was straight becomes curly, what was curly becomes straight, what was brown becomes gray, what was gray becomes brown. That kind of like permanent changes, 65% in one study. And I'm trying to find the study. If I can find it, I'll link to it in our show notes.
Okay. Yeah, I remember patients complaining that, oh, my hair came back and it's curly. And I would just look at them and just think like, oh my gosh, you have the most beautiful curls. Like, I wouldn't say that to them, but you know, but in my head, I'm like, oh, mm-hmm. I would die for those curls. Well, mm-hmm. now I have beachy waves and I have no idea what to do with them.
Beachy waves.
Beachy waves.
I'm learning all sorts of things about magnetic eyeliners and beachy waves.
Oh yeah. So you could have like these haircuts that are specific for curly hair, and they are like so expensive. They're like hundreds and hundreds of dollars, which is funny because like back in the day, I used to work as a receptionist at a hair salon. That was like my first job when I moved to New York. And I remember like people getting their hair cut and it would be like $200. And I thought, that's outrageous to get that much money, you know, to spend that much. Yeah. If you want a specific curly hair haircut in Portland, was like close to $400.
Get out of here.
No, I'm serious. And so I just don't cut my hair and I pile it on my head like you see it. And every once in a while, I'll trim off the dead bits. Speaking of the dead bits, I do want to mention that the Cancer Center Salon would recommend that when hair comes back in, when it's about maybe half an inch or so long, mm-hmm. which would probably be like a good month of growth or so, to shave your head again.
Shave it all the way down?
Shave it back. Yep. Because it'll come in healthier, apparently.
Oh.
What I experienced was I had a lot of split ends, a lot of fuzz, a lot of damaged hair as it came in. So because I did not do that. I was like, oh yeah, sure. I'll totally do that. And then that, you know, you get like a half inch of hair and you're just like, I am holding on to this.
Right.
You're not going to take it away from me. So I didn't do that. And I don't know. I ended up buying a plane ticket and flying to New York and spending a lot more than $300 to get my hair cut. But that's another little bit of advice for people is that mm-hmm. just to kind of get rid of that like initial hair that comes back in. I would get questions from patients as to when they could dye their hair.
Okay.
So I think the recommendation is about 6 months because, you know, as your hair gets all of the schmutz that, you know, has been in your body. I mean, think about like people use hair for drug testing, right? Like mm-hmm. if someone takes in drugs, it comes out through their hair. Well, guess what? You just got a bunch of drugs. It's going to come out through your hair. And so I believe the thought is that the hair color might not take the right way. You might not have the right pigment and all of that. So waiting 6 months, and I'm sure definitely cutting your hair to make sure all of that, what did I call it? Schmutz is out. I'm full on New York this episode.
I know you're full on New York. New York is coming out in you today.
All right.
That's not a bad thing. I'm just so we're clear. Hey, so in an ideal world, me being an idealistic naturopath that I am, if one is on the fence about coloring their hair, then not putting chemicals on your hair is probably the ideal scenario, or using pigments of nature that you might get on your hands when you're gardening anyways, or using henna, or using, you know, things that are non-toxic is the ideal scenario. And just putting that out there, don't hate on the messenger. I'm just saying in an ideal world, you're going to ingest what you put on your skin and you're taking great measures and maybe great costs, literally financial costs, to eat organically and do all these things to not put things in your body. So you might want to consider that for anything you put on your skin as well, whether it's hair dye or lotion, doesn't matter.
I wish people could see my face right now.
Yeah, I think if Leo was sitting next to me, she might throttle me.
Well, because so I have sort of semi-stopped dyeing my hair, and it was mostly because it started really coming in gray, and I was dyeing it with semi-permanent, like low toxic stuff formulas. It was gentler on the hair too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was, I was having to dye it like every 4 weeks. And so it was just, I was doing it myself and it was just really tiresome. Every once in a while, I'll throw on something to kind of tone down the grays because they're not quite coming in the way that I would like my grays to come in. But yeah, I mean, I'm not commenting on that. I would say do use something gentler. There are non-ammonia, non-formaldehyde formulas. There was a really cool hair color I used for Halloween when I dyed my hair dark purple. And it didn't have anything that it mixed with. I don't know what was in the actual cream that I put on my head, but it didn't use a developer or anything that was just kind of smelly or toxic. You just kind of put it in your hair and it lasted for quite some time. And it kind of tinted the grays purple and it was kind of cool.
Well, and you know me, I am not vested in people's decision. I feel like each person can weigh the risk and benefit to themselves. That is not for me to do. So whatever decision someone makes is their own because the risk benefit is a personal decision. And so my job is to define the risk benefit for people and let people make their own decisions. That's how I see it. So I just want to say it's not without risk. That's why you move towards the most natural substances possible if you're living by naturopathic principles.
You pick your poisons.
Yeah.
Literally pick your poisons. So there are products. I was looking on UpToDate to see if they had recommendations for regrowth, because like I said, they really didn't have anything for prevention other than the cold cap, which is more, you know, risk reduction. It's not going to prevent anything. One of the things I thought was interesting is that product Latisse, which is to grow eyelashes. So it's not really a recommendation, but it's more just like this has been looked at for people to use to help with their eyelashes growing back.
Oh,
because when things grow back, they don't always grow, like we said, that doesn't always come back the way that it was previously. Things that I noticed were that for years I had like waxed and tweezed my face. And when the hair came back, all that stuff that I had spent a lot of money grooming, all of that came back. So my unibrow came back. I mean, I got hair places where I was like, I don't remember that.
Wait,
it's been so long.
Are you saying places that you had, like, did you have something done that was supposed to be permanent?
Well, if you tweeze your hair, like your facial hair, long enough, it does stop growing back. If you wax enough, it does come back thinner, or, you know, it comes back more sparingly or whatever. So yeah, I mean, I even had electrolysis to have hair removed from my bikini line. And yeah, all of that comes back.
All right.
So that was that's a little heads up for folks.
I hadn't heard that before.
The other thing, maybe it was just me then.
But no.
The other thing which I thought was interesting was that peach fuzz, the vellus hair. I noticed that came back white and thick. Like I looked like a puppy.
Aww.
In my mind. But I didn't like do anything about it. I was like, oh, this will probably just fall out or whatever. And I was like, I'm not going to do anything about it. Because I had like this, like on my cheeks, I had like a downy fur. And I was sitting by the pool with my husband and our feet are in the pool and we're just sitting there. And all of a sudden he looks at me and he takes his finger and he brushes it along the side of my face. And I was like, wait a minute. And I just stormed in the house. I got out my wax strips and I waxed my face.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
So it wasn't until somebody like pointed it out to me that this is really noticeable that I did anything about it.
So can I just say you started the explanation by saying it was like a puppy and then ended it with giving it a little like, oh, it's so soft. I got to touch it.
Well, because I don't know how to describe it. It's like a peach fuzz, like a downy.
Well, I'm
peach
saying
fuzz.
It confirms exactly what you
oh,
cause said.
He does like the puppies.
I know your husband. I know he likes dogs, and I'm just saying he's like, oh, look at that. I got to touch it.
Yeah, and he's probably listening too. So,
well, we'll find out, won't we?
I will find out. Anyways, okay. So, other things that can be used once you know hair comes back, I have seen patients use a product called Nioxin. It's like a hair care system. And I think it has minoxidil in it. So minoxidil, it is available over the counter. I surveyed a naturopathic doctor that I know, Dr. Sheila Manning. And she told me that Jennifer Lopez has a product that is available. Also, that is a 2% minoxidil formula. She gave me some recommendations that some people have used for products. Huh.
Okay.
So
yeah, there's definitely data on minoxidil. topical.
Yeah.
So
it's just, I know with the niacin, people had to be careful to just make sure that it's not like running down your back or anything as you're shampooing, just to kind of make sure that your head's like over the sink or the bathtub so that you're not encouraging hair growth where you really don't want it.
Wow. It's that good, huh?
I don't know. That's what the stylist told me. So,
all right.
And that's why I didn't use it because I'm not that careful. And then going back to, you know, whether or not to use biotin, again, it hasn't been shown to help unless there is a frank deficiency. So, But there are a lot of those products. I know there's that Nutrafol product, which when you start Googling hair loss, those ads start showing up on Instagram. I have no experience with that at all.
No, I see the commercials. So Nutrafol, looking it up online as we speak, has ashwagandha, marine collagen peptides, vitamin E, curcumin, saw palmetto, kelp minerals, resveratrol, horsetail, and keratin, and then several nutrients, some of which we talked about, biotin and zinc, and then selenium is in there, and some amino acids and such, hyaluronic acid. So yeah, it's a combo of everything that's kind of being researched for hair loss. So think of it like a shotgun approach in that if too much testosterone is your issue, then there's saw palmetto in there, which should lower the active form of testosterone, which should lead to better hair growth. Marine collagen peptides have what are called bioactive peptides in there that can encourage growth. I don't know if I would go this far. That's fairly expensive for what's in it.
I think sticking with nutrition, because you're going to get a lot of that from food.
Again, you know, I do go back to the, what can you get nutritionally at $79 to $90 a month?
Oh, that's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. So if you're paying that per month, well, you've just increased your allotment for groceries a little bit if you don't take it. So I always think that there is a finite number of dollars people are using. So,
and you know, people continue to be on different treatments. And so I just am concerned with just, you know, whatever is in a pill, you know, again, looking back to see if there are any potential for interactions, anything with biotin will potentially interact with a lab. So what I kind of like topical things, I mentioned using coconut oil. You could also use, you know, sesame oil on your scalp. During treatment, but after treatment, my hair is thinning. I also pull my hair back really tight. So that doesn't help in terms of hair loss. But I try once a week. I haven't done it in months, but I was using a hair oil, an Ayurvedic hair oil. It's something you just leave on your scalp for 15 minutes and then wash your hair, and you can use it a few times a week. And that I really liked. I think when I was using it more regularly, I think I did notice a little bit more thickening.
Yeah, there's several Ayurvedic formulas. I have definitely tried those in patients as well. It's always hard for me to tell what's working and what's not, right? Because we do so many things with patients. But I have also recommended Ayurvedic herbal formulas that are topical.
Topicals.
Topical soaks, you know. Yeah, and I think they help. I mean, at the very least, a lot of them are oil-based and you're doing what is basically, remember, what was that called? The hot oil treatments that we used to do in the 70s and 80s, VO5.
Oh my gosh. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. It's kind of, at the very least you're doing that. And maybe the plants are helping. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, they have essential oils and plant extract. So that's something that I do recommend. I used it myself. I'm supposed to be using it and I'm just not doing it, but yeah.
So basically, first and foremost, I'm going to end it with this. Nutrition, nutrition, nutrition. Make sure you're replete in all your amino acids and your vitamins and that you're getting enough protein in your diet. And really it comes down to that because deficiencies will show up in hair and it's not prioritized as high as your organ function. So if you only have a finite amount of zinc, for example, the zinc is going to be used by your liver before you get to make new hair with it. So just make sure you have plenty of nutrients going in. That's probably number one thing to do post-treatment is make sure that you get your nutritional status back. It's all about replenishment post-treatment because treatment tends to be depleting.
So I just want to add again saying that it is more than just hair. Mm-hmm. And if for any reason you feel like this is stupid, I shouldn't be so upset over something that's so superficial, it's okay. I mean, for those of us who've been there, we've been there. We get it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Well, I think we should end on that note.
Okay. So yeah, we don't have a song. If anyone can think of a song, let me know. And
As usual,
subscribe, rate, and review. Speaking of subscribe to our newsletter. I might start throwing in a few more emails. I've only sent out one, but I might do a little update every now and then. Mm-hmm. And buy us coffees, because these are long days recording multiple episodes. And on that note, I'm Dr. Leah Sherman.
And I'm Dr. Tina Kaser.
And this is The Cancer Pod.
Until next time.
Thanks for listening to The Cancer Pod. Remember to subscribe, review, and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on social media for updates. And as always, this is not medical advice. These are our opinions. Talk to your doctor before changing anything related to your treatment plan. The Cancer Pod is hosted by me, Dr. Leah Sherman, and by Dr. Tina Kaser. Music is by Kevin MacLeod. See you next time.
Liver, beef liver.